Golf Smarter, number 519, published on December 21, 2015. Custom club maker Tom Wishon, talking about the upcoming ban on your anchored putters.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights to lower your score and raise your golf IQ. To hear the full interview and access hundreds of Golf Smarter episodes, sign up for premium access at golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Here's your host, Fred Green.
On January 1st, 2016, long putters, also known as anchored putters, will be banned for use in tournament play at all levels. Today's episode is actually a conversation we had with Tom Wishon explaining what it all means back in December of 2012, just after the ruling was announced by the USGA and RNA. This is the first time we've ever replayed an episode, and it's only happening because, well, not only is it timely, but we had technical difficulties recording this week's show. As we always try to do with Golf Smarter, our content is just as valid today as when it was originally recorded, and this is a perfect example. So enjoy, and thanks for your understanding. Welcome back to Golf Smarter, Tom.
Fred, thanks for the invite. Always happy to talk about golf clubs with you and your audience.
Well, thank you. And it's because our audience enjoys listening to you that I got an email from Steve Zintas of Baltimore on the 28th of November, just hours after the announcement. And Steve's email says, Fred, with the announcement of the USGA and RNA on the proposed ban of the anchored putter in 2016, I think that a great guest for you would be Tom Wishon, who uses the long putter and is a club maker. I think that he is always one of your best interviews, and I would like to hear his insight. So, Tom, here's your quarter. Go.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't really a surprise, let me put it that way, because those of us in the industry, and especially those of us who work in, you know, club design and engineering, we started hearing the rumblings, the serious rumblings, coming out of Far Hills around the mid to late summer. You know, so never in my career have I, you know, experienced a situation when the hints are coming out of Far Hills that a change is in the air. Never have we heard it turn around and go back and say, no, we're not going to do it. You know, so, yeah, and along with that, we kind of got an early indication that said that they're not really going to ban the putters outright, and this was not going to be an equipment rule change. This was going to be more of a ruling along the technique side. Bottom line of the whole thing is that, you know, even though these putters have been around for some 25 years or more, all of a sudden the USGA and the RNA decided that it was important for them to rule that all strokes at the ball be made so the hands were free of the body. You know, I mean, there's a bunch of us in the game who see that putting is a game within a game, and it's separate equipment. It's, you know, the putters don't have all the same specifications that the full swing golf clubs do. The motion, the swing, everything is different about it. But, you know, either way, you can't really argue the point, because this ends up being an arbitrary and capricious decision by the rulemaking body that this is the way they want it to be. Here's the reason why they want it to be that way, and nobody gets a vote. 12 people make this decision, and the rest of the 27 million golfers in the United States have to go in lockstep and say, yes, sir, you know, we'll follow you. Well, at least you'll follow them if you want to play in tournaments and, right, you know, in competition, that sort of thing. But, you know, as they usually always do, they're giving us 3 years, you know, or those golfers, you know, who use the body anchored style putting, 3 years to come up with some other way to do this, you know, and yes, it's true. They're not banning the putters outright. So if you have a long putter, and if you can adapt to the technique to move that upper gripping hand away from your body, you can keep using it. You know, so that's why it's important to understand this isn't a ban on equipment. It's just a, you know, a change in the rules for how the stroke has to be done. And for some odd reason, without ever looking at the scientific side of it, they were convinced that anchoring the, you know, the putter end to your body somehow gave you an advantage. And, you know, I happen to, you know, disagree with that, if for no other reason than we've watched these putters for over 25 years, and you know, I did a little rough math, you know, some months ago when I was thinking about this whole thing. And the action came, of course, because in 2011, all of a sudden you had a rapid increase in the number of tour events that were won by players using chiefly a belly putter, but a couple with a long putter, in both cases anchored to the body. From the time these things first came out, some 25 or 30 years ago, until 2011, there were something like 700 PGA Tour events played. Five of them were won by golfers using a body-anchored putter. That doesn't really tend to say that this is a, you know, a trend that's going to be a threat to the game.
Right, and those five winners, were they over that entire 25-year period? Was it just most recently with those five? So this is just like a reaction by the USGA?
No, they didn't even look at it because
really?
Because of the way that they chose to rule on this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if they were going after the putter itself, you know, yeah, you know, it would have made more sense to look at the performance issues to see, are these putters an example of technology replacing the skill with which to play the game? But they avoided all of that potential research or investigation by just coming up with an arbitrary and capricious decision that says a stroke at a golf ball has to include your hands being free of the body, you know. And, you know, that's the way it's always been with drivers and woods and hybrids and irons and wedges. You know, I defy anybody to try and hit a golf ball where you anchor the end of those clubs to the body.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It just doesn't work, you know. But all of a sudden, they just decided, well, the putter is part of all the other full swing clubs, and so we want to make sure that every stroke at the ball or every swing at the ball, the hands are going to be free from the body. You know, so it was, in a sense, you know, I mean, a way for them to get what they want without looking too bad, you know, I guess is one of the ways to put it. And at the end of the day, it is what it is. You know, I mean, there are, you know, there are many golfers who disagree with this because this is going to cause them some hardships to continue to play the game. I tended to look at this as being a matter that was more like custom fitting. You know, so you have golfers who use conventional shorter length putters. You have golfers that use longer conventional putters. You have golfers that use putters that weigh a lot and that don't weigh much. You know, you have all different styles of putters. You also have golfers who use the belly putters and the long putters where the end of the putter touched the body. You know, and it just so happened that this is what they felt they could putt better with. You know, and so they use it. I mean, that's no different than saying that your driver needs to be 45 inches long with 10 degrees of loft, a 1 degree hook close, you know, close face angle and all that, whereas, you know, mine is going to be 44 inches with an open face and 12 degrees of loft, let's say. You know, and so in essence, you know, it really is more of a fitting situation because you really haven't, and you know, I mean, just like you can't play with my driver and I can't play as well with your driver, there are
golfers that's okay.
Who
I can't
putt with a conventional putter and others who can.
That's okay. I can't play with my driver either, so.
Yeah.
Some interesting quotes have come out of this. USGA Executive Director Mike Davis said that throughout the 600-year history of golf, the essence of playing the game has been to grip the club with the hands and swing it freely at the ball. The player's challenge is to control the movement of the entire club in striking the ball, and anchoring the club alters the nature of that challenge.
Yeah, where was that written, you know, 575 years ago before, you know, the first of these putters came out?
Right.
That's what I say. This is an arbitrary and capricious decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, but it comes back into the USGA saying, no, we're not going to have two sets of rules. We're not going to have a set of rules for the tour and then a different set for everybody else. And yet, it, again, kind of is, isn't it? Because it's, doesn't it go into effect in the, on the tour immediately?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that, you know, the USGA, you know, it is only by behest of the PGA Tour that they decide to play under the rules of golf of the USGA. You know, I mean, tomorrow, if all of a sudden you had a number of guys on the ruling board of the PGA Tour who decided they wanted to, you know, write their own set of rules, they could do that. And the USGA would be, see ya. You know, and the only tournament then that the pros would have to play under the USGA rules would be the U.S.
Open.
you know, for that. So, you know, it just so happens that the PGA Tour doesn't want to create any real controversy and go out there and create their own rules for their own tour. So they agree to play by the rules of the USGA. And so when the USGA have people who don't like something about what's going on in either the equipment or even other aspects of the rules, you know, they can turn around, talk about it among themselves, get the support of the RNA, and go do what they want to do. And no golfer, no tour player, no one else can vote to say whether or not they disagree and think that this should be done in another way. You know, now, up until a few years ago, you know, basically the USGA did a pretty good job. I mean, and this is only my personal opinion, so please, you know, that's all it is. You know, I'll give you a good example here. The scoreline rule that came about in 2010, the whole origin of that thing was a number of people in the USGA getting bothered by the fact that you have players on the tour who could hit it 320 into the rough and still knock it on the green and make birdie or par. Right. They wanted somehow to be able to make, you know, hitting it further and crooked a penalty. You know, well, they couldn't go to the PGA Tour and tell them, grow the rough longer, because the USGA doesn't control how the PGA Tour sets up their tournaments. Mm-hmm. So the only way the USGA could, you know, do something about that was to try and go in and change a rule concerning the shape and configuration and size of the score lines, so that hopefully then when the players hit it 300 yards into the rough, they couldn't keep it on the green and they wouldn't be able to score as well. Well, that didn't happen. They made this rule. It was a very difficult rule for the manufacturers to ascribe to make their clubs to conform. And in the very first year that all of the new scoreline clubs went out on the tour, the players actually hit it closer to the hole from the rough than they did the year before with the old scoreline. So all of the money they spent, you know, to do this study, to try to come up with the way they wanted to change the score lines, to attempt to stop this, you know, form of play called bomb and gouge, it had no effect because they didn't take one big thing into account. Those guys who play the game on the PGA Tour are really, really good. And if they detect that the ball is not stopping as well when they hit a shot out of rough, well, they're just going to adjust and hit the shot about 10 feet shorter than they did before. So it releases and ends up, you know, about the same distance from the hole. And that's basically what's happened in all of that effort and all of that hardship that came as a result of that rule was for naught. It never had to be done.
That's so interesting. And yet, what kind of impact did it have on, well, you were talking about the club making industry. It had a big impact, kind of threw them into chaos.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that everyone I've spoken to who's in the engineering side of the golf equipment industry, no one can find any examples to where the USGA contacted the manufacturers of the iron heads to ask, you know, to talk to them and say, if we do the new grooves to look like this, how hard are these going to be to make consistently? They never did that. You know, they came up with their configuration on these score lines based on their laboratory testing to say that this won't spin the ball as much, and then it became a rule. And now it was the responsibility of the club companies, the club designers, and then the club head production factories to figure out how to consistently make irons with these grooves. And it is really, really difficult. I mean, I'll tell you this one thing right now. I would bet all the tea in China that if you took every set of irons made this year or last year with the new score lines and you conformity tested every single one, less than 50% would pass. Because you can make one set for, you know, USGA conformity testing with these new score lines and the way that they test them and get it passed, okay? But to be able to make 200,000 sets of irons a year and have all of those irons in each set have each score line that passes? No, I'll bet you less than 50% of the lines pass.
Wow.
Because this new score line groove shape that they ordained is incredibly difficult to manufacture with tight tolerance consistency.
And, you know, of course,
again,
without passing out those
they
prices.
They never considered that.
Yeah, and then, of course, passing those prices of consistency, you know, for the manufacturing, passing that along to the consumer, that's not going to be an easy thing to do.
No.
Just that's because, a, and what are you going to advertise?
Day,
right. What are you going to advertise? Hey, these have the new grooves. Like, so what? That doesn't,
you know, now I understand one thing, you know, I mean, we laughed about this at first when that rule came about, you know, leading into 2010, you know, because some of the manufacturer, you know, the other club design guys I talked to, they said, you know, gee, we hope they enact this immediately for all golfers, because then all of a sudden we're going to sell a ton of new irons. You know, well, they didn't. You know, they grandfathered in all of the old iron sets that had been conforming prior to 2010, and those were good until 2024. And that's as it should be, you know, because you can't make a rule change that all of a sudden puts all these golfers into a position where they got to go out and spend, you know, $600 to $1,000 on a brand new set of irons just because the rule has changed.
Yeah, of course not, because you want, you want those people to spend that $600 or $1,000 to go out and play golf.
Right.
I mean, isn't that
that's
more
exactly
important?
Right.
Wouldn't that be more important to the USGA that people are out spending money playing golf, not spending money on new equipment?
Yeah, and please don't get me wrong. You know, I mean, I'm going to be the first guy who's going to tell you that there is a tremendous amount of things that that the USGA and the RNA do, which is really, really good for the game. You know, the money they donate to research projects, you know, for improving the agronomy of the golf courses, this is wonderful. You know, the stuff they do like that. It's just that when they get involved with the equipment side of this, they're not using, you know, the best information, and they're not using the best judgment.
Hmm. You sound frustrated.
I'm sorry?
You sound frustrated.
It has been at times. It really has, because, you know, I'm always a guy, you know, who feels that if you have a, you know, discussion with an authority, that they're going to listen, or that if you know, that maybe you have a say, you know, in if they have some control over what you're doing. And that's a problem. I remember, you know, Dick Ruggie, who is the technical director of the RNA, I've known him for quite a number of years. You know, we were both on the Golf Digest technical advisory panel when Ruggie was a VP at TaylorMade before he moved and took the job of technical director of the USGA. Well, I was at a convention a number of years ago where Dick was one of the speakers there. And so at a break period, we were talking and I was asking him, you know, some of the, you know, how they were coming up with this decision or that decision and all that. And, you know, at the end of our discussion, he just smiled at me. He said, "Tom, you know, the USGA is not a democracy. We like to think of ourselves as a benevolent dictator."
Wow.
You know, I mean, and it is. And, you know, I mean, the industry, the golf industry has at least tried to lobby the USGA to say, you know, put one or two people from the equipment production and design side on the ball and implements committee so that we can be there to discuss these things. And, you know, because none of the other people who are on the ball and implements committee from the USGA ever came from the manufacturing side. They don't know what we do, and they don't know, you know, the science behind golf clubs that well.
Yeah, where do these guys come from? It's like they were members of golf clubs all their lives. They became board members of their golf club, and they just kept moving up, and then they got to the USGA. I mean, what does that have to do with the golf industry? And I'm just assuming. I'm not saying that that's, in fact, where these guys came from, but who do they represent?
Well, they select their own successors. Huh. You know, for one. So, you know, if somebody from the golf industry, you know, says, "Look, I'm going to try and work my way up to get on that committee," there's no guarantee they can make that.
Right.
You know, and, you know, so, you know, it is a difficult thing. I don't want to call names. It's just, you know, it's been very frustrating because they've not been consistent in the way that they have gone about making rule changes that affect the equipment side of the industry. You know, they have a credo, which basically says that drives their investigation of the equipment side of the industry. And that's to say, we never want to have skill replacing technology to play the game. You know, when steel shafts came in 1920, it automatically made, you know, hit the ball straighter, because there was much more resistance to torque in the shaft. That was technology replacing skill to play the game. I mean, if you really want to follow, you know, that credo and say we're never going to allow anything in equipment which is a technology advance which replaces the skill to play the game, then we all need to be playing with hickory shafts and wooden heads, you know, just like they did 600 years ago. Mm. You know, so that's not a viable guiding principle to look at rule changes. The other side is that you have to be doing, you know, real scientific research to really find out, does this piece of equipment, you know, adversely affect the game? And bottom line is that more times than not recently when they've made equipment rule changes, you know, it's been done more on an emotional basis and an arbitrary basis rather than a truly scientific basis.
And then who are these rules directed at? And this drives us to the question of, should there be two sets of rules? Should there be a set of rules for the pros, for the tour, and for everybody else? And there's a great line, and this is bifurcation, which they're talking about.
Right.
And Gary Player, it said in this article I'm reading, it says Gary Player tweeted. I don't know if Gary Player is doing his own tweeting, but he said, if you think the game is the same for everybody, just watch Tiger or Rory versus your club champ.
You know, I've always been one who's been against two separate sets of rules because I still got an awful lot of traditional aspects in me, you know, in my love of the game. You know, it is true. It's nice to think about the game that we play as amateurs for recreational purposes that, you know, it's the same exact game that, you know, all the big guys play for a living on the tour. Now, at the end of the day, how important is that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look at the other sports.
And really,
you know,
how true is that?
You have other sports where the pros play under certain different rules than the amateurs do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wood bats in the major leagues versus metal bats in, you know, college and high school. It's just a quick one that comes to mind.
Really, well, the only league in the world in for baseball, the only one that uses the designated hitter is the National League doesn't use
sure.
it. Every league from the pros on down through college and little league, they all use designated hitters. So, you know, they talk about the tradition of the game, but, you know. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry. It's a frustrating one for me, too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I think the biggest thing that has always bothered the USGA and the RNA is how far everybody's hitting the ball on the professional level these days.
Mm-hmm.
And is that having an effect to, you know, cause some of these great golf courses to be outmoded and they can never be used again, or they have to be lengthened to, you know, 7,600 yards. I mean, they had the announcement just the other day where the Lynx Trust and the RNA have hired a golf course architect to tear up the old course and redesign 9 of the holes. You know, so now you've got a situation where an awful lot of people are horrified that the home of golf is going to be, you know, torn up. Well, why? Because, you know, as the word was expressed to me by insiders, you know, the Lynx Trust and the RNA are scared to death somebody's going to shoot 59 in a British Open at St. Andrews and totally, you know, humiliate the Lynx. You know, well, you know, if you look at this, you know, there were several other golf courses that the British Open was played on that no longer are used because they just got outmoded. You know, Old Prestwick, Musselboro, you know. But there are a couple of golf courses that were used to play the British Open in the 1800s that are still being used, namely Muirfield and Hoylake. And both Muirfield and Hoylake have been torn up and modernized so that they pose a, you know, a challenge to the game today. You know, so, you know, it is one of these things that just happens. The game evolves. Now, a lot of people want to blame the equipment designers for all this distance that the pros are hitting the ball. And that's not fair. Because when this came out, you know, in a discussion I had with the USGA concerning that 1998 rule that limited the coefficient of restitution of club heads, you know, they thought all of a sudden, they looked at this and they said, wow, 1998, you know, the longest hitters on the PGA Tour are hitting it like 297, and back in 1972, they were hitting it 272. So in like, you know, 20-some years, you know, they gained, you know, almost 30 yards of distance, you know, with this. So it has to be the titanium drivers that have come about because they do hit it further, and so we've got to put a limit on them. And they never once went back and looked at a very simple statistic, which really tells the story. And that's the fact that if you go back into the 1970s and you look at what was the average driver club head speed among golfers on the PGA Tour, it was 104 miles an hour. And in the late 90s, the average driver club head speed had grown to 112. Now, in the physics of the game, 1 mile an hour, and this is true for every golfer, if you go out and you work out and somehow, you know, you come up with 1 mile an hour higher club head speed with a driver, than you've had before, that's 2.8 yards more carry distance. So if you gain 8 miles an hour, you know, what you're looking at is, you know, almost 22, 23 yards more distance automatically, you know, and the USGA didn't look at that to see that golfers were becoming better athletes. They were working out. They were training. They were doing more specific exercise and weight training for the golf swing. And there was so much money in the game that it was drawing some athletic kids away from football and basketball who had the money to learn to play golf, loved it, and now decided they wanted to pursue it as a career. You know, the majority, I'm not here to tell you titanium drivers don't hit it further. They do, but they don't hit it 30 yards further. You know, they hit it, you know, 8 to 10 yards further for the average golfer out there. You know, the biggest reason that we now have 500-yard par fours on tour events is because we have so many golfers who swing the club 115 miles an hour. You know, so at the end of the day, this is what bothers them. They don't like to see par four holes be driver wedge, driver nine iron, driver seven iron. You know, they still want to see par four holes where you got to hit 3 iron or 4 iron in, or a par three hole where you got to hit a, you know, a wood or a long iron in. And you're not going to get that today with today's golf athletes unless you want to make par three holes be, you know, 290 yards long and par four holes be 540.
Well, when you're watching tournaments on television and you'll see the advertising saying, play this ball, it's going to go farther. Use this club, it's going to go farther. You rarely, if ever, see an advertisement that comes on and says, work out more, lose some weight, increase your club head speed, you'll hit the ball farther.
Yep. Yeah.
It's like, oh. And we had, I can't remember who said it, but we had somebody on the show that was saying what he was, and I think it was a golf course architect who was saying what his frustration is that by increasing the distance of each of these courses, you're playing into these guys' hands. This is what they're doing. They're hitting the ball farther. You're not making the course harder for them. You're making the course harder for everybody else, but this is exactly what they want. They want to hit the ball farther.
Yeah, there's no question that distance is a huge advantage in this game. You know, I mean, and it also kind of helps a lot of us regular golfers feel how distantly remote, you know, separated we are from the great players. I remember going back into the 70s, you know, when I was 20 some years old and, you know, and my club head speed was the same as the average on the tour. So if I played some golf course that was used for a tour event, I felt like I could play, you know, out there with the tour players. Okay. Today, my club head speed is 99 miles an hour. They're 115 and higher. I can't play the courses they play.
Right.
You know, and this is why it's important to be able to follow things, you know, like what Nicklaus is pushing with his tee it forward, you know, concept.
Where, yeah, we had Barney Adams, who it was pretty much his concept, right? Barney was on the show just a month or two ago talking about that.
Yeah. I mean, those are good things. You know, yeah. We play the game for fun.
It's a terrible name, but it's a good thing.
You know, if you're a young, strapping, flat, you know, belly who's got 117-mile-an-hour club head speed, fine. Go back to the tips, stick ball on the ground, and play it at 7,500 yards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's your prerogative out there. But it's not right to have to sit here and complain about the fact that it's too bad courses have to be 7,500 yards long to play this game. Because let's go back to the, you know, 1870s and 1880s in the British Open when a long golf course was 5,800 yards long. You know, the rubber core ball, the wound center ball came around in 1900, all of a sudden increased everybody's distance dramatically, and courses had to be lengthened. So they did it before, and nobody really made a big issue out of it. But now all of a sudden it's a big deal if we have to go build new tee boxes, you know, and change the old course so that it becomes a little bit more competitive because the RNA chooses to continue to compete the Open Championship on an old, old, old golf course. You know, I think one of the things that's going to be really interesting, I think it's 2014 that the U.S. Open goes back to Marion Golf Club in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a golf course that cannot be stretched. You know, it's completely surrounded by old residential housing area, and they just don't have the real estate to lengthen it. So this golf course is going to have to play, I think, at a maximum of somewhere around 6,850 or 6,900 yards.
Okay? Could you say 2014 U.S. Open?
2014, yeah.
Yeah, it's at Pinehurst.
So it's going to be really interesting to see what the USGA does because they get so paranoid when the winning score of the U.S. Open is somewhere under par. And now they're taking the U.S. Open to a golf course that's 6,800 yards and some. You know, this is going to be really interesting to see what happens. You know,
the rough is going to be very, very thick.
Yeah, I think you're going to see 15-yard wide fairways. And around the greens, you're going to see, you know, 5-inch rough. And the greens will be starved of water, so they'll be like concrete. And you're just going to have a bunch of players hitting hybrids off the tee or 3-irons off the tee all day long and still hitting wedges in that bounce and roll and run off the green to where they're going to have to chip and putt.
Right.
You know, is that what we want to see, you know, in a competitive championship? I don't know. You know, to each their own.
Right. And you know, what you just kind of like briefly brushed over there, but lengthening these courses... what does that do to the impact of the maintenance of the course and what it takes to, you know, financially to run a golf course that is that much bigger, you know, because the maintenance costs, the watering costs are so huge for any golf course that by increasing that can really make things difficult to keep a golf course going if it's only for one tournament. Before we go, why don't we let everybody know, about your books and website and how to find a custom club fitter in their area.
You said it all, didn't you?
Okay, thanks. So we'll talk to you.
Yeah, we're all about custom fitting because we really do believe that golf clubs have to be matched to each golfer's size, strength, athletic ability, and most of all, their individual swing characteristics. So the whole business model of the golf equipment industry has been to package the technology of the club design into assembled club specs, which are all built to one series of standard specifications, with the only real choice you get between a R-Flex and an S-Flex that there's no standard for, so nobody knows exactly how stiff they are. So our concept is to really try to get the point across to golfers that they can have a chance to play, you know, a little better, play to the best, you know, to their natural ability if they go get custom fit, just like a tailor would for a suit. And to do that, you have to go find, you know, one of the independent custom club fitters that exists around the United States and the world. And one place, our website, wishongolf.com, right in the middle of the homepage is a find a club fitter locator. You know, these are guys that we've screened that we know personally who are more experienced and, you know, with whom you're going to get a nice, you know, a fitting experience and walk away with a very, very good chance of playing the game better automatically because of custom fitting changes. So that's what we're about, you know, and that's what I've devoted most of my life to. And I understand that there is a lot of bad information because of marketing about what golf clubs really do, what they can do and what they can't do. So golfers are really confused about that, so that's why I've also written a number of books, you know, that are aimed at explaining in very understandable terms, you know, how golf clubs really work and how you can select them to, you know, get more out of your natural ability. So the books are all available through our website at the top of the homepage on wishongolf.com. There's a little listing up there that says Golfers Store. So if you click and pull down Golfers Store, you can go find the books and the best ones for the golfers. If they really only want a short bit of information, we've got a little 32-page booklet called 12 Myths That Could Wreck Your Golf Game. If you want a little bit more information than any of the books called The Search for the Perfect Golf Club, The Search for the Perfect Driver, or The Right Sticks. You know, would be ones that, and they're interesting. I mean, I understand that this technical side of golf clubs can be, you know, conveyed in a way that's like watching paint dry, you know, with that. So I've tried to write this, you know, in you know, even with a little bit of humor to poke fun at things, you know, so it's, you know, a little bit more interesting to read so you can learn about your golf clubs.
So if you didn't hear the reminder last week, our announcement that through the end of January, you're going to get the full interview each week, just like our premium subscribers. Now, with the free version of Golf Smarter, you're generally only hearing a short segment of the complete interview. And once we start cutting down the shows again back up in February, I really hope that you'll sign up for premium access. As is our general practice with free versus premium, the free episodes are only available online for a few weeks, but the premium subscribers have access to our complete library of shows dating back to 2005. Now, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future guests, please visit our newly launched website and click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.